Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Every 4 years, American voters have the opportunity to go to the polls to pick new national leaders. But does power really change hands? As we'll learn in today's program, since World War II, there's existed alongside our nominal democratic government a permanent and hidden power structure controlled by powerful economic interest that uses covert and sometimes illegal means to pursue its own agenda. Please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts, The Deep State. Welcome back to History Counts. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. We're happy to have as our guest today Peter Dale Scott. We're going to discuss how the elite use covert power inside and outside of the government to advance their own agenda without regard to the democratic process. Professor Scott is a man of many talents, a poet, a diplomat, and a political researcher and writer. He served in the Canadian Diplomatic Service from 1957 to 1961, and he was professor of English at the University of California, Berkeley, until retiring in 1994. Professor Scott has written numerous political books, including The Road to 9/11, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, Drugs, Oil, and War, and his most recent book, The War Conspiracy, published this year by Mary Farrell Foundation Press. His website is www.peterdalescott.net. Professor Scott, thanks very much for being with us today.
I'm happy to be with you.
In The Road to 9/11, you write about the ongoing tension that exists between the national security state, which you sometimes call the deep state, and the public state. Could you talk about that?
Yes, in every major power, but particularly it's apparent in America since World War II and the creation of the CIA, it was felt that the CIA, that America had to have powers dealing with the rest of the world that were not appropriate for close congressional surveillance. So essentially a group of lawyers and bankers in New York, Wall Street, like people who recognize some of the names like Alan Dulles and others from the past, Jim Forrestal, who became Secretary of the Navy, they decided in New York that America should have a CIA. And that was not enough. In fact, that could have, we wouldn't be talking about this if they hadn't then, from within CIA, created yet another organization, which many Americans still have never heard of, called the Office of Policy Coordination, or OPC, which was the beginning of dirty tricks. And it was given instructions to subvert the governments of other parts of the world, in effect, to break the law.
Now, the CIA really starts during World War II with Alan Dulles, who's a partner of Sullivan & Cromwell, the large Wall Street law firm, and a president of the Council on Foreign Relations. As president of the Council on Foreign Relations, they start pushing the idea that the intelligence group, the OSS, needs to be perpetuated. Is that right? And they start pushing for the establishment of a post-war CIA?
The key figure pushing was the head of OSS, General William Donovan. But the Council on Foreign Relations, they had these war peace studies groups, which was a very odd thing. It was part in the government, part out. People were participating from the State Department and the Defense Department. And meanwhile, but the meetings were essentially being chaired up in New York for the most part by members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And they were designing a whole structure for the post-war.
And Alan Dulles is tasked by James Forrestal to come up with a charter for an organizational structure for the CIA. And Forrestal himself comes from a Wall Street investment bank, president of Dillon Reed.
And the interesting thing was that, of course, Alan Dulles was a Republican, but all of this was happening under Truman.
Well, Donovan was also a major New York lawyer. Donovan Leisure was his firm, a World War One hero. And the committee that Dulles organized to, you name the members of it, to set up the CIA, I noticed they're all private citizens, the managing partner of Dillon Reed, Representative Brown Brothers Harriman, lawyers from the Wall Street firm Carter Ledgert. Was there any congressional oversight?
Well, there was a sentence in the National Security Act which said that they would create a CIA to perform such functions as the National Security Council shall from time to time direct. That's not very specific legislation. If you look at the first of the deputy directors of the CIA that we know of the seven that we know, all were either New York lawyers or New York bankers.
And you also mentioned that the organization of the OPC, this covert operations group, was actually done at an investment bank. The meetings were held under Dulles with a committee of lawyers at an investment bank called J.H. Whitney, not at a congressional hearing.
The Congress had the chance to ask questions about the CIA when they passed the National Security Act. They had no chance whatsoever to say anything about OPC.
What was Operation Paper about, and who was Paul Helliwell?
But the original idea was that when the Chinese communists drove the Chinese nationalists out of China, most of them went to Taiwan, but a few of them took refuge in the eastern part of Burma, which is it's all tribes, they're not Burmese, and it was not under the control of Rangoon. And the decision, Operation Paper, was the decision made in Washington to supply and arm and build up those forces. The idea was that they would reinvade China, and they did actually once or twice go into Yunnan, were immediately repulsed. I don't think they tried very hard, because I think their bigger interest, these Chinese nationalist troops, was to build up a local drug traffic, because the KMT, which they the party behind Chiang Kai-shek, had for decades financed itself from the drug trade, and it had also maintained its contacts with its party groups down in places like Bangkok or Jakarta or Saigon. All of it was through the drug trade.
Now, Paul Helliwell was, as you write about in your book, who was former OSS. He was a member of the CIA, the OPC. He was also, you say, a lawyer for Meyer Lansky's money laundering Miami National Bank.
Yes, but that's true. But before we get to it, we have to see that the OPC set up two proprietaries to help the Chinese nationalists. One was an airline. Its ultimate name was Air America, and everybody's heard about it. The other one was something called Sea Supply, Inc., which was a company in Bangkok. They haven't heard about it. But they were working with the drug traffic, and the drug traffic profits were being invested by the underworld in banks. Now, Paul Helliwell was the officer in OPC who created both of those proprietaries that worked with the drug traffickers. But he was also, in public, a Miami lawyer. And, he owned two banks, and at the beginning he owned more later. But these two banks were being used by the CIA and OPC, and they were also being used by Meyer Lansky. It's not so surprising, because the funds that came out of Thailand, by the way, that opium was coming to the United States. It was a really shocking situation, and Lansky and the OPC were in bed together in Burma and in Thailand, and it was perfectly natural that they would be using the same banks.
Through the drug profits, were these operations essentially self-financing?
Well, everything in the Far East was self-financing.
And they were off the books, so there was no public record or counting?
Of course, I'm speculating here, because no one has ever done me the favor of showing me the CIA's books.
Right.
But I think when we get to the scale of a 35,000-man army in Laos in the 1960s, the Congress found out about that and held hearings into it, and were complaining they'd never been told about it. So I assume that all of that was financed more by the drug traffic than it was, you know, that whatever input there was from the CIA's legitimate budget was minimal compared to what was happening. That was built up slowly but continuously from about 1950.
So the Laotian operation, this creation of a private army financed by the drug trade, that sort of was a continuation of Operation Paper?
Yes, it grew continuously out of Operation Paper. An intermediate stage, Donovan, you know, we were talking about before, was sent as ambassador to Thailand. And while he was there, the CIA had already helped set up some Thai border police, the idea being keep the communists out, but they were financing themselves from the drug trade. And then under Donovan, they set up, they had a CIA man set up an army which was designed not just to defend Thailand, but to attack, to go. They made contact with the people we call Hmong in Laos, and they also unseated the neutralist government in Laos and put in a right-wing government. They got very involved in Laotian politics in a way which produced, I really say it was the CIA first, then the North Vietnamese responded, and we got a war in Laos, which eventually blossomed into a full-fledged Vietnam War.
Now, this pattern of drug involvement, you say, continued more recently in the 1980s with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan?
There was a kind of scaling down in the 70s, and coincidentally, America's heroin epidemic also scaled down towards the end of the 1970s. Zbigniew Brzezinski maneuvered us into Afghanistan, and that he actually boasted that what he was doing in Afghanistan drew the Russians into Afghanistan. So we had a reprise of what had happened before, only now it wasn't the Golden Triangle anymore, it was now the Golden Crescent, and a country which had not exported heroin before or even opium, or just used it locally, suddenly became a major heroin exporter. And today, of course, Afghanistan is responsible for 93% of the world's heroin.
And Vice President Bush was an important figure, the father of our current president, as far as these covert operations goes?
I'm not sure how much he was responsible for the drug part, but his office oversaw the operations in El Salvador, which were financing the Contras, and this Ilopango Air Force Base, once again, was also doubling of its 9 warehouses. I think 4 were for drugs and 5 were for the Contras, something like that. And on the case of Afghanistan, I think the key figure was really Reagan's director of Central Intelligence, William Casey, who was an old colleague of William Donovan's in OSS, the last of the OSS people.
Is it during this period that BCCI becomes important?
Yes, exactly. And BCCI is a Pakistani bank, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was very buddy-buddy with William Casey. Casey didn't like the CIA. He was the head of the CIA, but he disliked most of the people in the CIA, thought they were too namby-pamby after the Watergate reforms, and he liked to deal directly with the head of BCCI, which was not just a bank, it was a drug laundering bank, and according to some books, a drug financing bank with its own covert operations staff. And Casey would meet one-on-one with the Abedi, the head of BCCI. And the fact that we got so involved with drug traffickers in Afghanistan, so that something like half of our aid in Afghanistan in the 1980s was going to a man called Gulbedin Hekmatyar, who at the time may have been the leading heroin trafficker in the world, that drug bias of our aid in Afghanistan can be attributed, I think, to the fact that in the initial stages, BCCI was supplying the infrastructure, the shipping, the trucks, everything needed to get aid to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. The same trucks were bringing the heroin back out.
Well, I'd like to move, if we can, from this discussion of the covert operations abroad to a discussion of covert operations at home. In your book, you present information indicating that for about 40 years, people inside and outside the government have been laying the groundwork for establishing a martial law state, which is now called the continuity of government. Could you talk about its origins in the Army's Operation Garden Plot during Vietnam?
Yes, well, continuity of government, which is COG for short, is a set of plans which have been worked on. They built on earlier plans for how to deal with an emergency. And initially, this planning was all how to deal with a nuclear emergency. But in the 1960s and 70s, when we had a great deal of protest against the war and about human rights, all kinds of issues in the 60s and 70s, you got a second kind of planning, some of it in the state level, very advanced in the state of California under then-Governor Ronald Reagan. And then when Reagan became president, he took his director of emergency planning from California and made him head of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And they started planning for continuity of government on a federal way. And two people who have been involved in that planning from the beginning, three people, this is where George H.W. Bush comes in. He was involved in that planning. And his gopher that for doing little tricks here and there, Oliver North, Colonel North, was involved in the planning.
They called it a National Program Office, which sounds pretty innocuous.
Yes, so it's always things like, you know, Office of Policy Coordination, National Program Office. Then there was yet another name after George W. Bush was elected.
When you discuss the Vietnam War era, the origins of it, you can see which direction it's going. I was interested to learn that the Pentagon established at that time in the 60s a Directorate of Disturbance Planning, and the headquarters for this organization, the Pentagon, was called the Domestic War Room.
Well, of course, you know, I don't blame it all on the Pentagon. They were dealing with a real crisis in the country. You know, Detroit went up in flames, and after Martin Luther King was assassinated, the city of Washington went up in flames. Well, Giuffrida, Reagan's emergency planning director, was a racist and a kind of a madman. He was thinking of rounding up blacks. Some people say by the million. That's hard to believe, but certainly in very large numbers.
Well, really, it was also tied into the FBI's COINTELGROUP, where Asian provocateurs would infiltrate groups.
Right, and Army intelligence was in on the picture, and in those days the CIA was in with their what they called Operation Chaos in the 70s. They ostensibly they were doing surveillance on domestic groups, but when you get informants, when you plant informants in groups, and their success rate depends on having good news, those people almost always become provocateurs, whether or not they were sent to be provocateurs. That's what they become. And I had personal experience of this when I was in the anti-war movement in the 1970s and later.
As the program matured in the Reagan administration, President Reagan actually assigned an executive order which called for the suspension of the Constitution under certain circumstances?
Well, I can only deal with that by saying that very question was asked of Colonel North in the Iran-Contra hearings with an amazing response. And the response didn't come from Colonel North. It came from the chairman of the Iran-Contra committee hearing, who was a Democrat, Senator Inouye. He banged his gavel and he said, "We can't go into that in a public session," which meaning, and really admitting that there were plans for the suspension of the Constitution. And there are two books about that planning, one by James Mann and one by James Bamford, and both of them have spoken to a veteran of the planning who said, "Well, if we're dealing with an emergency, what would the role of Congress be?" And the people doing the planning said, "Well, it's just too complicated to bring in Congress, so we'll just plan for a government without them." So that in itself would be a suspension of the American Constitution.
And you note that people who were important in working on the continuity of government plans under the Reagan administration, including Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, then end up as important officials in the Bush Jr. administration.
That is correct. And the astonishing thing is that Cheney and Rumsfeld have been in on this planning from the very beginning, and continuously through the 1980s, when Rumsfeld wasn't in the government at all. He was the chairman of a drug company, G.D. Searle. And in through the 1990s, when neither Cheney nor Rumsfeld were in the government, because Cheney became the chairman of Halliburton, but they continued to plan for COG. And let's be very clear about this, because a lot of people don't understand it, that COG was implemented on September the 11th, 2001. We don't know what that means. We don't know if it was just a little bit of COG or if it was a great deal of COG, but I think it's pretty clear from what's happened since that three elements which had already become clear in the 1980s were actually instituted after 9/11. And the first is warrantless surveillance, and there's been a lot of talk about that since. Another, about which there's not been enough talk, is warrantless detention, the suspension of habeas corpus. That happened right away for a number of Muslims in this country, and it's happened for other people, and I wrote an article about how Halliburton, KBR, actually, I should say, Cheney's old company, got a contract, almost $400 million contract, to build detention centers in this country for people who were being rounded up without a warrant. And then the final thing, which is definitely has happened, and in such a large way we almost don't notice it, is the preparation for martial law. And they have created a military command now for North America, and they have begun to accustom us for the use of the army in civilian ways.
This is the Northern Command?
NORTHCOM, yes.
NORTHCOM, yes.
You have a SOUTHCOM, you're right, it is the Northern Command.
That's the first time we've had such a command within the United States.
Within the United States, and actually this affects Canada too, because Canada has always had a Canada command, but the head of NORTHCOM and the head of CanadaCOM signed an agreement, a military agreement, allowing for the forces of one to go into the country of the other, and this has had quite a major impact on Canada, because now American submarines are going into Canadian territorial waters, and they can say, well, there's this agreement.
And I understand that the Northern Command, which was, I think, basically a staff operation, was just recently assigned a regular combat infantry brigade, and that brigade is presently being trained in tactics of suppressing civil disorder, including the use of tasers.
Right, and another thing which is the kind of people who listen to this show should be aware of, that they have had been conducting war games, and as far as we can make out, according to Associated Press, they mounted a war game, Operation CyberCom, which was against bloggers, because one very clearly, if there is a martial law declared in this country, then the whole status of the internet will, freedom of speech on the internet will be radically impacted, and they have had war games on how to deal with bloggers, or with what Rumsfeld called people like me, and I'm probably, there are a lot of bloggers listening to this show, and they have plans to deal with bloggers. They have rehearsed them in war games.
What can people do to try to reassert control over the public sphere in the United States?
Well, I think they have to activate the Democratic Party to be more upset about this than they are now. And a good test of this was in 2007 when Bush renewed the state of emergency that had been proclaimed in September 2001. And he did in a document which had secret annexes about providing for continuity of government. And Congressman Peter DeFazio from Oregon said, I would like to see those annexes. He's on the House Homeland Security Committee. And he was told he didn't have the clearance to see them. So then the entire House Homeland Security Committee, Republicans and Democrats, said that they wanted to review these documents. Let's not forget that they had been described in a back in the 80s as plans for the suspension of the Constitution. And you would think as long as we have checks and balances in this country that Congress should review any plans which call for the suspension of the Constitution. They were told in writing they could not see those plans.
I've heard you also talk about the need to create new alternate institutions which are independent of the state. Could you talk about that?
Well, I think that we're in politics are important and everyone should get out and vote in November. But politics today, party politics, isn't offering an alternative to this drift into deep state government that I've been talking about. We have to build our own institutions. I'm not calling for outright violent revolution here. I'm calling for building institutions which will have the power eventually, they wouldn't at first, to challenge this whole fabric of government in which the big issues like the deep state are not being discussed at all. And so I point to the example of Poland, where they planned for 20 years to get rid of the Soviet army, and by golly, they did, within the Solidarity Movement. And the leader of it said, you know, that you had to change people's minds, and it took 15 or 20 years to do this. John Adams said the same thing about the American Revolution. He said it wasn't the war. The war came in when the revolution had succeeded, when the revolution was changing people's minds, and that was, I think, Adams said it was 20 years, and Michnik said it took 15, but it's the same idea that when your established institutions aren't serving their purpose, you have to build new ones to reorient the direction of government.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Professor Scott. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been talking about covert operations and their impact on democracy with Professor Peter Dale Scott, author of The Road to 9/11. His latest book is The War Conspiracy. You can find Professor Scott's website at
www.peterdalescott.net.
And we'll also put a link to it at historycounts.org. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. While today's program concerned covert operations, there are also many overt ways in which the wealthy influence democracy. For example, corporate ownership and sponsorship of the media, through which public discourse can be controlled, a campaign finance system that relies on large infusions of private money, extensive lobbying operations that give the wealthy preferred access to elected officials, and the selection of important government policy officials from the ranks of powerful corporations. With respect to the last, consider the influence of just one bank, Goldman Sachs. Robert Rubin, Goldman's chief operation officer, became Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton. Hank Paulson, Goldman's chairman, became Treasury Secretary under the second President Bush. Robert Zoellick, the Bush administration's top trade official, became a Goldman managing director before taking his next job as head of the World Bank. And Stephen Friedman, former head of Goldman, chairs the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, whose 16 members consist largely of private citizens from influential banks, law firms, and industries, including oil. Meanwhile, Mr. Friedman still sits on the Goldman board. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is broadcast on the first Thursday of the month at 12:30 p.m. and on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. It's produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.